This is WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscowain. School classrooms increasingly use digital devices like e-books and tablets instead of printed textbooks, those nice, big, hefty things that many of us grew up with. Researchers are learning that students often don't comprehend as much when they read from electronic devices. Joining us to help us understand this a little bit better is Benjamin Harold, staff writer for Education Week, where he covers education technology and writes the Digital Education blog. He's also a former reporter here at WHYY. Welcome to Radio Times, or welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
And Heather Sugar is Associate Professor of Literacy at Westchester University, where her research focuses on reading, comprehension, and technology. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And on the phone is Naomi Barron, Executive Director of the Center for Teaching, Research, and Learning, and a Professor of Linguistics at American University. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone.
Good morning. And Ben, I want to start with you. These digital devices in schools, how prevalent are they? Are they showing up more often now?
Yes, it's really the digital revolution that has come through other parts of American life have really started to come through schools in a big way. So one way of thinking about it is it was really just 4 years ago that Apple introduced the iPad, and already they've sold more than 4 million of those to U.S. schools. And it's not just iPads. There's laptops, there's Chromebooks, the inexpensive notebook computer. They are increasingly popular in schools. So really these devices are everywhere. And it's not just devices, it's also software. The major trade association for the software industry recently estimated that it's an $8 billion a year market selling digital curriculum, digital content, digital learning tools to schools. So it's really a sea change from probably how you and I experience school, and it's changing very quickly, and it's also changing in the home. There's a lot of research showing just how prevalent smartphones and tablets and mobile devices are for kids. Common Sense Media, one of the leading nonprofits that does research into this, now estimates that 75% of children under 8 have a mobile device in their home, and that more than one-third of children under the age of 2 have used an app or used a video. So really, for children today, digital learning is where it's at.
And I saw in one of your stories that almost 1 in 3 public and private school students in the U.S. now uses a school-issued mobile computing device.
That's right. What we see is a lot of schools and districts around the country doing what is known as one-to-one computing, where the idea is to get a digital device in the hands of every student. I was actually in a school in Texas last fall where the idea was it's not just one digital device. We want every student in the entire district. It's called Louisville Independent School District outside of Dallas. Every student should have access to a laptop, a tablet, and a smartphone at all times, with the idea that that's how the world works right now. And I would imagine if you and I sat down and thought about how we did our work, sometimes we're on our phone, sometimes we're on our computer, sometimes we're on our tablet, and schools are going that direction too.
And we have a couple of researchers here who are going to help us really get into the science that's an important part of this discussion. But maybe you could help us with kind of an overview of what researchers know about how kids use these devices and how much they comprehend when they use them.
Well, I think the starting point is just realizing that the technology moves much faster than the research, particularly when we talk about serious, academic peer-reviewed research. So again, the influx of devices has happened very rapidly before there's really been a chance for the research to catch up, and likewise with the software. Generally, I think what we're starting to see is that there's both a lot of optimism and faith and a growing body of research that shows that these kind of digital devices and tools are great for student engagement. They get kids really excited, really motivated. Kids are very excited to use them. And they can also be really good for teaching procedural skills. So in math, kind of how to solve problems or doing kind of a lot of practice and repetition. Where the early research raises a lot more questions is on the kind of deeper learning activity. So not just kind of how do you solve the problem, but understanding why that is that way. Or in the case of reading, not just kind of skimming through and finding the right piece of information, but really starting to kind of make connections between texts and be able to draw inferences and do all of the kind of deeper things that that reading is ultimately really about.
And Heather Sugar, here in the studio, you're with Westchester University, and you work with your husband. You both do research in this area?
Yes, we do.
And and you've been looking at how middle school students, how their reading comprehension is with e-books on iPads. What have you found?
We've been looking with middle grade students, so those are ages in grades 3 through 8,
And with that, we've been looking at students who have typically struggled to read, and we wanted to look at books at a level where we would expect they would be able to read with acceptable comprehension and decoding with a teacher's support.
What does decoding mean?
Decoding means how they read the words. Are they able to, you know, word call or recognize the words that they're saying?
Oh, so is that comprehension?
It is. That would be more like the phonics-based or the sight word types of information, not whether they're understanding. But, of course, okay. Those two things are related.
Okay.
So we were looking to see when we gave students a digital copy of a book, and we were looking particularly at interactive books that are available. We were using iPads. So the types of books that have all the bells and whistles, they have animations that move, they have games embedded, lots of things going on there versus the conventional version of the book. And we wanted to see how their reading was similar or different across those two books.
And so when you have these books with all of the bells and whistles, what happens to kids when they're reading through that? What's different?
Well, what was great is we found that they were able to read the words the same across the two types of books. But when they were reading on the interactive books on their iPad, we found that they read at a much slower rate because they were spending a lot of time playing with the different features. And I say playing because that's really what they're doing. You know, they're making things twirl and twist. And then we also found that their comprehension seemed to rely more on those animations rather than making the types of inferences they were making with the conventional books. So it was not as strong when they were reading on the digital books.
You talk about sort of playing instead of reading. There was one particular book, Sir Charlie Stinky Socks. Tell me about Sir Charlie Stinky Socks.
Sir Charlie Stinky Socks was a book where it's this adventure of this child who's going on this adventure, and they have all kinds of things you touch, and the things are making sounds like the wiggly woos are howling, and eyeballs are popping out at you. And we had students, when they were done reading that book, say things to us like, I have no clue what I just read. And they had gone through and they had read aloud each of the words to us, but they had no clue what the meaning had been because they had spent so much time with these interactive features.
Wow, that's extraordinary. Let's bring Naomi Barron into the conversation. And some of your research has focused on an older population, millennials. What are you finding with millennials? And tell me, remind me, what are millennials? That's older than 18, I guess?
yeah, and every year they get older and older. So the generation that I look at is university students, essentially undergraduates, from about age 18 to 24. So, you know, they are coming of age in the new millennium, which to us is now 14 years old, but that's the population. I became very concerned about the mismatch between what the commercial sector is pushing in terms of devices and in terms of e-books, as opposed to what we think we know about education, and that's K through 12 plus higher education. So I thought one way to look at this problem is to ask students themselves, what do you think? How do you read? What would be your preferences if, for example, cost weren't the issue? Many people say, gee, I wish I could buy the hard copy, but you know what? It's cheaper to buy an e-book. So I designed some studies. I looked both in the United States at undergraduates. I looked in Japan and in Germany. And here's some highlights of what I found. If you ask students, if the cost were the same, would you prefer to read in hard copy, print, or on some digital screen if you're reading for schoolwork? And somewhere around 90% across those countries said, I prefer hard copy. These are the people who are using their other devices all the time, the people who are texting in my classes on their phones. But if you ask what do they prefer for schoolwork, they'll tell you it's overwhelmingly print. You also ask them, what do you prefer for reading for pleasure? Well, maybe that's different. Well, that's in the high 80s, preferring hard copy as well. Okay, if we're talking about learning, one of the ways you learn is by rereading something. So you ask, are you more likely to reread something if you're reading in hard copy or reading on a screen? Surprise, surprise, you're more likely to reread if you're reading in hard copy. And that even goes for reading for pleasure. in some of my studies, I've asked people, you know, what do you like most about reading in print or reading in hard copy, or reading on a screen? And they'll tell you, I bought a book and I read it as an e-book, but I liked it so much I wanted to read it again, so I bought the hard copy. And I find teenagers, you know, middle school age people saying the same thing around the country, around the world, rather, when you look at those data.
What is it about the hard copy? Is it just the holding it, or what's going on there?
It's many, many things. So one of it is the holding it, because you've got a sense you're doing something. I've had students in Japan say, it's not really reading if you're reading on a screen. Well, what does that mean? Well, it doesn't have that look and feel and smell. You'd be amazed how many students, and I have colleagues who are doing similar research in other parts of the world, how many university students say, I like the smell of a book. I thought you had to be over 60 to like the smell of a book, but it's absolutely not true. People will tell you they like the feel of tooled leather. Well, they may have never held a book with tooled leather, but that's part of the notion of what a book is. They want to put their fingers in it. They want to see for real how far they've read. Some students tell me, I forget the author, but if with hard copy, I can just flip over and see who it is. I can navigate on the page. A lot of students say what they like most about reading in print is, I remember it's in the upper left-hand corner, and it's about a third of the way through, and they can find their way again, rather than having to do a word search, and you have no physical sense of where you are.
Wow. So, Ben Harold, we're getting a sense here that there's a kind of conflicting relationships with our electronic devices. What are educators doing with that information?
Well, you know, I think I'll start with a personal story, if I may, because this when I wrote about digital reading, it was really fun and really enjoyable to go into, because I've actually felt guilty as a technology reporter, because I print everything out on paper. So for this story, I probably read 12 or 15 different research articles, and then I had them all printed out so I could highlight them and do all that. And I think I came to this reporting with the idea of, okay, which is better? Is print better for comprehension, or is digital better? And what I started to learn from being in classrooms and talking with vendors and talking with researchers is that it's really, there's lots of different types of reading, that it's actually a very different activity depending on what you're doing. And I think if we think about our everyday activities, that makes sense. If I'm scrolling through Twitter while I'm, you know, waiting at the bus stop, you know, I'm doing that on my phone, and that's one activity. But if I'm, you know, sitting on the beach and reading a trashy novel, that's a second activity. And if I'm trying to make sense of, you know, one of Heather's scholarly articles for the research, that's an entirely different activity. And that different media might be better suited for each. And I think that what some of the more forward-thinking educators out there are starting to do is say, we need to think about promoting good reading skills in both. It needs to be a biliterate brain that's both print and digital, and there might be different sets of skills and strategies associated with each.
And we're really going to get into that issue here throughout this hour. We're talking about digital devices in the classroom, and not just the classroom, but also how everyone uses digital devices. My guests are Benjamin Harold of Education Week, Heather Sugar from Westchester University, and Naomi Barron of American University. How do you feel about your electronic devices? Give us a call, join the conversation, ask a question. The number is 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Back in a minute.
Supporting WHYY, the 2014 Lincoln MKX with 305 horsepower combined with an EPA estimated rating of 26 mpg highway. Actual mileage will vary. More details about Lincoln MKX at Lincoln.com.
This week in This American Life, what it's like for writer David Sedaris, living in France, struggling with the language.
This is my worst nightmare right here. Okay, my lighter has run out of fluid, which would mean that I would have to ask somebody for a match. And so what I would say is, hello, do you have some fire?
Americans in Paris, why the French may be right to hate us.
I will not spend the afternoon asking people if they have fire.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. As Natasha Trethewey ends her tenure as poet laureate, we'll get her thoughts on the form.
Well, isn't it wonderful that poetry gives us a way of saying exactly what we mean and meaning it, and meaning something else at the same time.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
J.
Join WHYY June 26th for the third annual Best of the Chefs. You vote to crown the winners at a two-hour tasting featuring an array of local restaurants and businesses. Tickets and more information at whyy.org/events.
We're talking about digital devices, e-books, and how we comprehend when we read something digitally rather than from a piece of paper. And we have Benjamin Harold of Education Week here, Heather Sugar from Westchester University, and Naomi Barron of American University. You can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. And Ben, let's go back to you. We were talking about how educators are responding to sort of this emerging information, because as you said before, the practice is advancing faster than the research to know what to do. So what are educators doing? How are they trying to give skills to kids to read from an e-book better?
I think they are in some cases, and I think educators are just starting to realize the need to do that. And Heather's work and others have really helped to highlight that. And you know, I think in some cases it's specific skills and strategies of things that we do that help us understand. So when I need to comprehend something very technical for work, I like to print it out, and I have my highlighter, and I like to organize things in those ways, and that's how I grasp it. But you know, I think one of the interesting things from my perspective in the work that I do is that I see a lot of technology companies trying to come up with digital tools that help to do that. And some of the software and apps that are making their way into classrooms are really fascinating. So you see there's a company, for example, called Achieve 3000. And what they'll do is, you know, be a single classroom, and everyone's reading the, you know, content about the same thing, you know, the Declaration of Independence, for example. But there'll be 12 different versions of the story geared towards different reading levels. And so the idea is, you know, if you have advanced students, they're not suffering through something that's boring. And if you have students who are behind, they're not just sitting there in a fog. They're reading something that might be more at their level, but everyone's getting the same content, so you can learn in that way. And, you know, there are some really kind of high-tech things out there as well that, you know, turn reading into a game, and, you know, where you have to there's a company called Amplify that has a new English curriculum where you learn about, seventh graders learn about Edgar Allan Poe by, you know, solving a mystery of who killed him, and it's a social game that changes every time that you play it, and there are algorithm-driven characters that might ask you about what you read as you play through the game. And so, you know, there's a wide variety of different tools, and I think educators are really trying to catch up at this point.
So, Heather Sugar, that idea of sort of turning reading into a game, what do you think of that?
I think anything we can do to get kids reading and interested in reading, and other ways that we can assess students besides sitting them down with a pen and pencil, is fantastic. I think as educators and parents, what we really need to be thinking about is, are we assessing what we're trying to assess? Are we actually looking at the skills we're trying to look at? Is reading, are we actually looking at reading here, or are we looking at a game? And it gets blurred, that line between reading, games, books. Sometimes it's hard for me to figure it out, and I research this stuff.
It is difficult to figure out. And I want to switch to Naomi Barron here. We received a tweet from Sue that I think would be a good one for you to answer, since you work with a college-age population. Sue says, I work at Barnes & Noble, and when students need a book, often an e-book is all that's available.
So here we have a conundrum. Sometimes it's all that's available because it's not the kind of book that most of us would want our students reading. So I go onto Amazon site all the time, and I could go onto Barnes & Noble, and there's this cascade of prices. And one of the major problems is the pricing structure for print. And a lot of people are saying, well, if I put something together that's, let's say, open access, which is really nice because then there isn't a price attached to it, that all tends to be online. There's a bill before Congress right now saying, let's have an initiative to create open access books to reduce the price of textbooks, which is so high that it's driving students not to buy the books, not to rent the books, not to read the books. So we're defeating our purpose in education. But the challenge there is we're getting used to thinking digital is fine, it's a cost issue, it's a convenience issue, and I understand all that, but there's a question of, should we be saying there has to be the opportunity to have a print version? So you can do print on demand without having without having to charge an arm and a leg for doing it. But we have to have a model that says, aha, we know something about what the research is really starting to tell us, not just about comprehension and learning more generally, but also about what students would prefer, because they're no dummies. They know what they learn from and what they don't. Simple statistic. You ask people, on what kind of device do you concentrate better? And they'll tell you that they concentrate overwhelmingly, more than 90% in all three countries I looked at, say, it's easiest to concentrate if I'm reading hard copy. You ask them how often they multitask. If you say, how often do you multitask when you're reading in hard copy? About 4% of people. How often do you do lots of multitasking when you read on a screen? Somewhere between 50 and 60% of people. That means your mind isn't there. Educators have an obligation to both listen to our own brains, read the research, which is starting to come out, and listen to our students, rather than worry about what we think is going to be cost-effective, because there are other solutions if we try hard enough to figure them out.
We have some folks who'd like to join the conversation. The phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let's go to the telephone, and we have Donna from Ambler. Donna, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My school district recently adopted the one-to-one computing platform, so all of our kids are now getting computers, and I'm finding that there's really a difference in their test scores and how they study, and my kids really prefer to bring their books home with them because they have an easier time with them.
So they want your kids want to bring, but explain that a little bit more, Donna.
Well, they have their books on the computer, and we were told that's what they would be using. But my kids bring the hard copies home consistently because they find it easier to study.
That's really interesting. And I think, you know, I've seen and heard similar stories, including from students themselves in schools. I was in a high school in Manahawkin, New Jersey, not too long ago, Donna, and there was a ninth grade student who said a very similar thing. You know, in his classroom, they were reading texts related to the Odyssey, the classic Greek poem, and they were reading online on the new Chromebooks that the school had recently purchased. And I was asking this young man, you know, what do you think about this? Do you like reading it this way? And he was like, oh, yeah, it's great. If I, you know, given my choice, I would really, you know, I like reading on the computer, but I don't understand it as well. And so he kind of had that sense as well. And I think, as both Naomi and Donna are saying, you know, kids have a pretty good sense of what their own experience is reading it. And, you know, I think a lot of the research is starting to reflect that, too, of saying, you know, it's not, you know, you kind of need to dig below the surface, and it's not just about what device it is or not just about what media it is, but really to look at the context of the interaction. So even if we're talking about young children, you know, there might be a big difference between, you know, a kid sitting by themselves using one of the gazillions of kind of Learn Your ABCs apps that are out there versus a child, you know, reading together with grandma over Skype. And those are two very different things, and we shouldn't kind of treat them all the same. So, you know, I think it's important to look under the hood a little bit.
So, Heather Sugar, that's point. I'm sorry, go ahead, Naomi.
I think there's another point that we have to think about in terms of how education has shifted in terms of our goals over the last 10, 15 years, particularly as electronic devices have proliferated. And that is, an awful lot of the goal of knowing something when you have read is shifting to the goal of being able to look it up, to find it somewhere. So part of what's happening with electronic devices and learning, I think, is linked to what we're teaching students it means to know. And we've changed our tune as to what knowledge is about. And lots of studies that have appeared in such places as Science and whatever that show people may not remember what they read, but they remember the search path of how to find it. And maybe that's okay. Well, I'm not sure it's okay. So if indeed we are changing our notion of what it means to read to be find what you found before and not have it in your head and your heart, then students are doing the right thing. And I think we can't separate the technology from the educational goals.
Heather Sugar, I can imagine a lot of parents sort of thinking about this issue and thinking, okay, I want to do the right thing, but I'm getting a lot of information here, and clearly the research, it's not progressing as fastly as the deployment of these devices. So what kind of advice do you have for parents, sort of examining how their kid interacts with books and sort of making decisions from there, I guess?
Yeah, this is something I'm really interested in myself, because I think that we see a lot of schools and even parents of young children giving these types of devices to children, but not really giving them any strategies for how they should use or read from those devices. So in my, you know, ideal kind of situation with the situation going on in Ambler, what I would like to see would be teachers giving students specific strategies for when you're reading in your paper book, this is what strategies you're using. Now this is what it looks like when you read on a computer. Here's how you apply those strategies. And I don't think it's the device that's causing the problem. I think it's that as educators and as one myself, we haven't really caught up. We haven't started teaching kids how to read from those types of devices.
Hmm. Let's go back to the telephone. We have Gwyneth from Bucks County. Gwyneth, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. I agree that we need to start educating our kids how to use a tablet, et cetera, because I think what some of the research is measuring is the adaptability between learning how to read on a book, and then transferring that to electronic devices. Because I have three kids, none of my kids picked up a tablet from the time they were, you know, a year old. They picked up hard copy books. So you're measuring the adaptability from those hard copy books to electronic books, and not really, like, if you enclosed a baby in a, you know, in a bubble and just gave them the tablet or an iPhone or whatever, that would be measuring how they actually learn on that device.
So do we know if it makes a difference if a child starts out with an electronic device or starts out with hard books when they're young? Is that something that you know about, Heather Sugar?
Well, one thing, there's been some research out of Temple that's really interesting, because they looked at parent-child interactions when kids were reading from tablets. And what they found is that while parents were doing all types of things to work with kids on their comprehension, asking them questions, looking at the illustrations when they were reading conventional books, as soon as they got on the tablet, it all became about swiping here, touching there, make this move. And so it became a lot more about actually using the book and not about reading itself. And so I think that's what we need to look at. And I wonder if we only gave kids tablets, if because as parents we still haven't made that shift, if that conversation would still be more about the function.
Well, and Ben, this really gets back to your point that you need more research.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to really look at what the different digital tools and products do. And again, there's lots of software and apps that are out there. One that I paid close attention to in the reporting for the story that I did is a company called Curriculit, which is it's a year-old company, and already they have about 100,000 students signed up and are likely to have a lot more soon. And one of the things that they do that I thought was really interesting is they really try and strip out a lot of the bells and whistles and say, you know, we agree with Heather and Jordan's research, and we agree with some of those findings. And what we can do is build into the technology some of the tools that help bring those strategies from print over to digital. So what you would see is as students are kind of reading using this app, there might be kind of embedded annotations where the teacher can kind of say, hey, this section is really important. Go back and read that again. Or they might be able to put in a YouTube clip that would provide kind of extra context or information about it. And at the end of each chapter, there might be kind of comprehension questions that really kind of force a young person to say, did you understand what you read? And when I talked to the CEO about this, I mean, he was very adamant that, you know, we should not get kind of lost in these kind of idealistic and in some cases very elitist notions of what reading is. He said for a lot of students, you know, it's not this, his phrase was, it's not a bucolic intellectual romp. It's really like kind of trying to run in quicksand, and you get further and further behind. And he was, you know, a very strong belief that technology can really help hold kids and teachers accountable for making sure that kids actually do the reading and not, you know, kind of stare blankly in the back of class.
And Naomi Barron, I almost get the sense that because of this emerging technology, we're almost sort of re-examining how we read, where for a long time we weren't really even looking at that.
Right. Well, there's a whole spectrum of kinds of reading, whether it's skimming or scanning or reading what I call in a one-off manner. That is, you're going to read something, take that trashy novel at the beach, and you want to read it, but you don't plan to reread it, as opposed to something you might come back to over and again, or something that you want to learn from. You know, so we think of college or high school texts. What's pretty clear is that if you look at adults, and one of the callers was saying, you know, my kids are starting with hard copy and then they're moving to digital, so they already have that grounding. The sad news is if you ask people who make the shifts, even who shift back and forth as they get to be high school students or young adults, they will tell you they tend to be sloppier in their reading. They tend to be more distracted. And you know what? It's not their fault, because if you have a device that has an internet connection, plain and simple, we're not talking about the original Kindle, we're not talking about the Kobo reader that has no internet connection other than downloading books. If you have any device, digital device, that has an internet connection, it is very, very tempting to go somewhere else. Or you could have games loaded on your device. You don't even have to have the internet connection. And the problem is we are human beings. You put a bowl of potato chips in front of a group of teenagers and say, don't eat them. Dinner is in half an hour. You put it in front of me and tell me dinner is in half an hour. And we can't control ourselves. There are devices, there are pieces of software you can buy that will turn off your internet connection for whatever time you set so you can do serious work. Why are we paying money for this? Because we can't control ourselves.
So
part of the problem is the nature of the device.
So should I assume that when you have something important you want to read, you print it out?
You betcha I print it out, and when I have writing I want to do, I go to a place, this is true, that does not have internet connection, because I know I will not get distracted. I mean, unfortunately, my phone now picks up my email, but I say no more than once an hour do I go look at it. And in terms of training ourselves, because the digital devices are not going away, we're going to have to figure out how to do that. You know, I agree with my colleagues on this program. We have to figure out how to do that. We don't have the answers yet, but we have to think about the nature of the device, not just what kind of software are we going to put onto that device.
So, Heather Sugar, I'll ask you the same question. When you have to read something that's important to you, how do you choose to read it?
I print it out, absolutely, and then I rescan it back in and store it digitally, and then I end up printing it out again.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of work, but you take your research seriously then, and or the findings of your research. And Ben, what do you do when you have something that you need to read?
I do a lot of printing out for the serious reading that I do, but you know, even as we're sitting here talking, I have my laptop in front of me and I'm checking out the Twitter conversation as we go, and so you know, I find one of the things I've really started to realize is that, again, there are very different types of reading, and that different media and different devices or different technologies, including paper as a technology, are good for different pieces of that. And you know, one of the things that was most rewarding about the reporting that I did is actually got an email from my aunt, who's in her mid-60s, after the story came out. And she said, you know, it was like the most validating thing to read this, because I thought it was just me. Like, my grandchildren read on their Kindles or their iPads, and I thought I should start trying to do that too, and it just seemed so easy. But I didn't like it, and I thought it was just because I was old and out of touch. But maybe it's not just me.
We're talking.
Could I come back to something having to do with?
Well, we need to take a quick break here, but we still have a little bit of time after the break to talk. We're talking about digital devices and reading comprehension. My guests are Ben Harold of Education Week, Heather Sugar from Westchester University, and Naomi Barron of American University. We have folks on the line to ask some questions of our guests. If you have a question or a comment about our discussion, the telephone number is 1-888-477-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break.
Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcoming clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and relationship problems. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. On the next Fresh Air, how the Koch brothers became America's most powerful and private dynasty. We talk with Daniel Shulman, author of a new biography of the Koch family. We'll discuss how they created the second largest privately held company in America and the roles family members played in the John Birch Society, the Libertarian Party, and the Tea Party. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
how do we engineer affordability?
A prosthetic leg can range from $15,000 to several hundred thousand dollars, depending on the quality of the limb you're looking at. Just completely out of the reach of the normal person.
Two engineering students discuss how to design low-cost prosthetics and how to make them accessible to the world's most vulnerable people. It's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Benjamin Harold of Education Week, Heather Sugar from Westchester University, and Naomi Barron of American University. The topic is digital devices, your Kindle, your e-book, your iPad that you read off of. If you want to join the conversation, then the number is 1-888-477-9499. Let's go to the telephone, and we have Julia. Julia, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
Well, my name is Julia Maurer, and I'm the academic dean at Mercersburg Academy. We're an independent boarding school in southern Pennsylvania. And I have kind of an interesting perspective on this. We've recently become a one-to-one iPad school. We adopted a universal technology platform at the school. And our faculty, we started an initiative a couple years ago when iBooks Author came out, writing our own textbooks for classes. And we right now have, our own faculty have created over 22 e-textbooks over the past couple of years, and we've got more coming this summer. And so I have a perspective on that from our work that we've done with our own books.
And Heather Sugar, this seems familiar to you?
I am cheering for you right here. We're really working hard to help our pre-service teachers at Westchester learn how to make textbooks in just that way so that the books are more accessible for students, include the content that is really valued by the teachers. And so I'm so excited to see that you have a school-wide initiative to do that. I think that that's where some of this technology can really start to make a difference, and schools can really kind of bypass some of the large textbooks that contain a lot of information, but not really much information in depth on any one topic. You can really delve into what you're interested in, your students knowing.
And go ahead, Ben.
I'd be curious to hear from both of you, if I may. Just what do you see teachers being good at and not so good at when it comes to creating their own textbooks?
I think, like she said, we created e-textbooks where there wasn't a great printed text available, or for courses like my own, I teach a class in robotics where there just wasn't a text available, and so everything I was doing on my own with PDFs and demonstrations anyway, so I was able to take all of that and put it into a book for my students, or where printed texts just don't conform to the classes, you know, the subjects and the way that we teach them. And there is the cost issue as well. We give those books to our kids for free.
Sure.
Our faculty, in terms of the content, they really know what they want to put in the books. And so that's been a strength. We've had to learn kind of the design layout. We spend a lot of time, you know, as faculty figuring out how to put it together in an attractive way for the students and in a way where they'll want to engage, you know, with it.
All right. Well, thank you, Julie. I want to get an answer from our guest here. Heather, first, maybe you could answer that question that Ben posed of what do teachers do well and maybe not so well?
We've gone out into some of the local public schools with our books. Students have created them for those particular class curriculums. And we find that the students are really good at taking a specific content and really going in depth on that topic. The problem we're seeing is like what we saw when PowerPoint first came out. They're throwing in all kinds of stuff. There's videos, there's things flying, there's picture galleries. There's way too much going on. And like when we first started with PowerPoint, people had things buzzing in. It was very distracting. And so as we've gotten to use PowerPoint a lot more, you see the very basic kind of book. And we're kind of hoping they start to use iBook Author a little more like that.
Say no, Naomi Barron, if a teacher wanted to create her own textbook on an iPad, what kind of advice would you offer?
Be smart and talk about what you really care about. If you think back to a number of years past, at least in universities, when faculty members didn't find a book that did what they wanted it to do, they would put together their own compendium, often of other people's articles, and then, you know, if you were good, you got copyright permission to include them in that course pack. So the notion of doing something like that or adding your additional written pieces to it as an ebook is a carryover of a principle that says faculty should teach what they think is most important to teach. Clearly, there are design principles that you have to work on. The only thing I would add to this, I would add two things to this piece. First is there should be an option for students to get a print-on-demand copy if they wish it. And to that, I would add the research that I've done that says if you have a short piece to read, if you have a long piece to read, what do you prefer? This is, again, 18 to 24-year-olds, the United States, Germany, and Japan. And they are really clear, both reading for schoolwork and reading for pleasure. Overwhelmingly, if the piece is long, they want it in print. If it's in short, if it's a short amount, it's all over the map. So students have a real sense of what they learn best from, and we've heard that a lot during this program today, and I would want to make sure that an ebook, which can be a terrific resource, has an alternative so that people could use both if they wish it. And there are many students who read the same text, sometimes on screen and sometimes in print, and they use it for different times of day for different purposes.
Well, this sounds like a perfect time to bring a student into the conversation, then. And we happen to have one on the telephone. Alex is on the line, and Alex, you're on Radio Times, and you're a student, right?
Yeah, so I'm an engineering student, and I own an iPad, and I also own hard copies of my books, so I have them in the two different formats. And what I usually like to do is, especially in engineering, because there's a lot of graphical stuff, we have some heavy books, so I usually study at home and leave my books at home. And when I'm in campus, I like to bring my iPad, and since I have my books on, I use them as reference. And another thing I like about the iPad is that if I have questions or doubts about something else, I can go to the internet real quick and look more into it. But I was wondering, I also own a Kindle. So is there the reason I like reading on the Kindle, especially for pleasure, is because I don't have all that brightness in on the eyes. So I was wondering if you were asking college students what they prefer for reading, for pleasure, or for work.
Alex, thank you for...
Did any question about the Kindle come through?
Thank you, Alex, for calling in. And Naomi, it sounds like Alex has sort of worked out a situation that's good for him.
Right, and it's a situation, it's a scenario that actually a number of students, particularly those who are serious about their studies and have heavy books, use two versions. And publishers, but not for textbooks so much, both for pleasure reading, are now making available, Amazon makes this available, it's called the Matchbook program. If you bought the ebook, you can also get for free or for very little money the hard copy. I'd like to see that happen for textbooks because I think that will make for better learning. In terms of what kind of device is good for reading for pleasure, it depends on where you read. Are you reading in bed? Are you reading out at the beach? And there are a lot of people who find it comfortable to read on, say, a Kindle or Kobo or whatever version if they are not disrupted, if they don't have an internet connection, and if the screen has a good enough resolution that it's comfortable on the eyes.
And Ben, you have a point to make here?
Well, I think one of the things that I have found really interesting in the reporting I've done on this is that for subjects like engineering, which was interesting that Alex brought up, or complex science, that some of the digital reading can actually be very helpful with comprehension, particularly for very complicated processes. One of the things that you see a lot of the digital instructional resources carrying now is kind of interactive tools that let you see, for example, cell processes and see them unfold. And it's really hard to kind of describe that in words and, can be a turnoff for a lot of us. It was for me when I tried to take science classes in college. But, being able to kind of see it, I think for things like engineering or complex science can be a really useful tool and one of the affordances that digital media offer.
We have a tweet from Ali who asks, do young kids have screen fatigue, and is it the same as it is in older people? Is that a question that you can answer? Maybe this is another area where Need more research.
I haven't seen as much about screen fatigue with young children, but we do have a sense that screen time is very much on the rise, and that for, you know, 2 to 4 year olds, the current estimate is two hours or more a day on screen, about half of which is generally deemed to be educational. And as kids get older, it's more screen time, less of which is educational.
Hmm. Let's go back to the telephone, and we have Judith from Flemington, New Jersey. Judith, you are on Radio Times. Judith, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to talk a little bit about my son's experience and then ask the panelists what they feel. My son has numerous learning difficulties, ranging from dyslexia, dysgraphia, dyscalculia, and auditory processing, you name it. So everything's been a struggle. Actually, reading was not so much the problem, but it was organizing all the information. And so when he got older and the projects became very complex, he had to move from his comfort zone, which you is like a technophobe. He had to move from his comfort zone of everything in paper to everything digital. And what we were able to do for him when he got to like college age is he uses Dragon to write his papers. And when he has to do technical readings for papers or taking notes, he takes all his notes in OneNote. He copies and pastes what he needs to write with, to write a paper with or to study from. He puts it all in OneNote because of his dysgraphia, and typing is even difficult for him. So,
did you have a question?
Yeah. So I was wondering, and also multiple streams of information coming are a problem. And I was just wondering if they've run into this, if there have been any studies on kids with learning issues. I know that they've been using reading iBooks for dyslexia for a long time, but in terms of the whole comprehension and note-taking and moving from paper to digital, has that been studied at all?
Let's put that question to Ben Harold. There's a lot of people want to know about this issue, and there's just not, the research just isn't out there.
Naomi and Heather, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I have not seen any research about special needs students in the way that digital technology gear works for them or does not work for them in terms of reading. But what I have seen is some really amazing technology, some of which our caller described, that are geared toward to helping those students' needs. And so it could be something as simple as, you know, really allowing for a larger font size. So for students who have sight difficulties, being able to see things, having kind of auditory tools embedded in, which can be very useful for students from in all different circumstances, including English language learners who are trying to learn learn English. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of really kind of just cool and interesting and potentially very helpful technologies out there for special needs students and others. The research, as far as I've seen, and correct me if I'm wrong, isn't quite there yet on knowing how effective they really are.
Okay, I think we have time to squeeze in another call here. We have Ethan from Kennett Square. Ethan, you are on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. This is probably another show, but all this discussion of reading puts me in mind of how much writing has changed for me. I write a lot for pleasure, and as a student, when I was a student, and through my job, and I started on a manual typewriter, and then moved to a typewriter that just had one line that you could see, and then moved on to writing on a word processor, and now writing on a computer that has an internet connection. And my thought is that the things we read have also been really heavily affected, and through editing, for example, it used to be that you had to think out the whole sentence before you typed it, because it was hard to change, and now I find myself sort of backspacing all the time. So I think it's an interesting thought that not only is technology changing the way we read things, but it's also changing the way those things are written.
Yeah, I guess go ahead.
It's changing the mechanics of how we write without a doubt, but it's also changing the length and the conceptual sophistication of what we write. I mean, if you look at the changes in publishing, you look at how short books are becoming statistically, you look at how much time we spend on a website, and the answer is our attention is very short. So an awful lot of what's happening now is shorter writing is resulting from the fact that people are willing to read less amounts because their attention span is shorter. So you're right that writing is being affected, but it's not just in the production. It's also in the production yourself of a sentence. It's in how long is the text? What are publishers finding they can make money on? And I think the whole notion of what publishing and writing as authors is about is going to shift as a result of the ways that we read on screens.
Well, I think journalists around the country share your lament of the increasing emphasis on short writing.
Yes, I know that journalists share your lament. But one thing that we can say that has not changed is that an hour is still an hour, and we're almost at the end of our hour, so we can squeeze in a little bit more here. We have a comment from Stephen who says, how can you highlight on digital devices? He likes to do this in print, and it sounds like he doesn't like using a digital device because he can't highlight. Although I do almost all of my notes for NPR online, and there's a little highlighter tool in Microsoft Word. But go ahead, Heather.
Most apps will allow you to do that. One of the problems we have is that it requires a lot of cognitive flexibility to be able to figure out how the particular app you're using will allow you to highlight. It's not like when you pick up a book, highlighting's always the same when you do it on a traditional book. It changes with every app you open online. And that's one thing we've been working with the students at Radnor High School, because that school has really, I think, done it right. They're really a model because they aren't just giving the students the devices. They're saying, we need to teach the kids how to do what we want them to do on these devices. So we've gone in and provided training to the teachers for how to do things like that, how to highlight, how to annotate, you know, how to take notes when you're using these devices.
I think you just called me cognitively flexible. That's really sweet. Well, this is such an interesting topic, and we're just about to wrap it up here. Benjamin, I'm just going to, I have a lot of information to say about each of our guests, so I'm going to go ahead and do that. And Benjamin Harold, you're a staff writer for Education Week, where you cover education technology, and he writes for the Digital Education blog. Previously, he was with WHYY and NewsWorks. He was an education reporter and also a contributor to WHYY's partner, the Public School Notebook. Heather Sugar is an associate professor of literacy at Westchester University, where her research focuses on reading, comprehension, and technology. And Naomi Barron, Executive Director of the Center for Teaching, Research, and Learning, also a professor of linguistics at American University, where her work focuses on the role of technology in shaping language. Thank you all for being here with us today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find all kinds of information about the program. The engineer today is Adam Staniszewski, and the producers of Radio Times are Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscoing.